Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. To start this episode, we'll hear from archival interviews with two men who hated each other with a passion, Robert F. Kennedy and James Jimmy Hoffa. RFK had this to say about Hoffa.
You're not too disappointed in the fact that you have missed two court convictions of Mr. Hoffa?
Well, that's not our purpose. I don't think that he belongs as head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Yes. I think that that is a national disgrace and most unfortunate. But that is not our problem. I think that we have presented the facts so that Congress should act to deal with these difficulties. Because even if you get rid of Jimmy Hoffa and don't have legislation, you'll have a new Jimmy Hoffa that'll come along in 5 or 6 years.
And Hoffa felt this way about Kennedy.
And Kennedy said something to me, and I said, then listen, punk, you are a complete liar, and I'm tired of your nonsense, and I don't want to hear about it again. Now, you just shut up, and don't cause me no more trouble. The whole thing blows up. Got charges against me, obstructions and everything else.
When John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, labor leader Jimmy Hoffa was heard to say, quote, Bobby Kennedy is just another lawyer now. The animosity between Hoffa and the Kennedys dated to a famous 1957 Senate investigation, the so-called Rackets Committee, led by Robert Kennedy. That very public hearing began a lifelong feud between two powerful and dedicated adversaries. James Neff is a Seattle-based journalist and the author of Vendetta, Bobby Kennedy versus Jimmy Hoffa. Here he explains what it took to uncover the origins and consequences of an epic enmity. Robert Kennedy believed Hoffa was, quote, crooked and greedy. When he became Attorney General in 1961, Kennedy created a Get Hoffa Squad. Hoffa, who rose from poverty and a ninth-grade education to become the president of the Teamsters Union, looked on the Kennedys as, quote, spoiled brats, who had little understanding of the working man. Investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch calls Vendetta not a book about a good Bobby versus a bad Hoffa. It is a study of two men who always got what they wanted, staging a shootout on the streets of Laredo. James Neff has directed multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning series as investigations editor at the Seattle Times. His books include The Wrong Man, Unfinished Murder, and Mobbed Up. Neff spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 13, 2015. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Elliott Bay's Rochelle Best starts the introductions.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to the Elliott Bay Book Company tonight. We're very happy to have you. What a great turnout. So we are pleased tonight to welcome James Neff. He is a journalist and investigations editor at the Seattle Times, which many of you apparently know, which is very exciting. He's overseen a number of Pulitzer Prize-winning series, and he's the author of The Wrong Man, Unfinished Murder, and Mobbed Up. We're here tonight to celebrate his new book, Vendetta, Bobby Kennedy versus Jimmy Hoffa. We're also happy to have Marianne Gwynn here tonight, who will introduce James a bit more thoroughly in a moment. She is the longtime book editor at the Seattle Times. She's also a board member of the National Book Critics Circle and the co-host of the television series Well Read. So following the reading and Q&A, we'll have a bit of a signing in the back of the room where books will also be available for purchase. And thank you again so much for being here tonight. Please join me in welcoming Marianne Gwynn.
Hello. Lots of friendly faces in the audience, that's great. Can you guys hear me? Yeah. I should be standing on my toes. I've known Jim for a long time, and I've known a lot of other reporters at the Seattle Times that have written books. And one of my interesting parts of my job is that I've become a sounding board of sorts to them as they go through the editorial process. And I'm always glad to listen because writing a book is a lonely job. If you're writing a novel, you're basically trying to pull it out of your imagination. If you're writing a nonfiction book, you spend a lot of time with librarians. who become some of your favorite people. Then, of course, you have to sit down and write the sucker, which is the loneliest job of all. Then you turn it in and you wait, and it can be a long wait. Here's a list of very short list of stories I have heard from Seattle Times authors over the years. I turned my manuscript in 6 months ago, and I haven't heard a word from my editor. My editor has stopped answering my emails. My editor just left my publishing house and moved to another. My old editor left my publishing house. I have a new editor who's 18 years old. I could go on to other predicaments, but we're here to talk about Jim Neff's book, Vendetta, Bobby Kennedy versus Jimmy Hoffa. Jim has been working on Vendetta as long as I have known him, which is as long as he's been at the Seattle Times. He's been with us for 14 years as investigations editor, and during that time, he's overseen the coverage that won us 3 Pulitzer Prizes. He's a great newspaper journalist, but I love listening to him talk about writing a book. He did not list the usual author complaints. His tales were about digging for and finding great stories. His face-offs with various keepers of various Kennedy archives were fascinating. They would open and close seemingly at a whim. One week, the secrets would be laid open. The next week, the doors would snap shut with the ferocity and mindlessness of a Venus flytrap. His deep dives into the 1960s were revelatory. I was a teenager in the 60s, and the Kennedys had achieved martyrdom because of the assassinations of John and Bobby. Jim's research revealed a whole nother side to the milieus that both John and Bobby operated in. There were colorful characters such as Fred Otash, the private detective who spied on the stars for the Hollywood newspaper Confidential. Fred would later be immortalized in the James Ellroy novel L.A. Confidential and the movie of the same name. Jimmy Hoffa contacted Otash, hoping to dig up dirt on the Kennedys. Jim will have to tell you how that turned out. Then there were the stories of Jimmy Hoffa, an angry man wielding unrestrained power, such as the assault on Victor Reisel, a New York labor columnist who made Hoffa mad and who was subsequently blinded by an acid attack. I heard so many fascinating stories from Jim. My only fear about Vendetta was, A, it might never be finished. How can you ever be done with the Kennedys? Or B, it would be 1,000 pages long. Neither fear came to pass. Vendetta clocks in at a smooth 377 pages. It is all muscle and no fat. It reads like a thriller, but has the resonance of a Greek tragedy, especially since the reader knows that within a few years of the time of the story, both protagonists would be dead. When I was growing up, I thought Bobby Kennedy was a political saint. I thought Jimmy Hoffa was a devil, a labor racketeer who ran a crooked union with unrestrained power. Now reading Vendetta, I know it wasn't that simple, but it never is it? Here's Jim.
Thank you, Marianne. That was beautiful. I mean, it really, you can see why she's such a, you can see why Marianne is such a good book critic and book editor. She nailed it. Thank you for coming out. I'm really happy to tell you about Vendetta. And it's interesting, Marianne didn't tell you this, but it actually started as an idea for a documentary. And so I was actually My partner was Oregon Public Broadcasting. We were trying to set it up with Frontline, or if not that, something like the History Channel. And so I went to Teamsters headquarters in Washington, D.C. to use their library, see if I could get access to some of their files. And it didn't take that long before they brought me into this one area and they said, oh, maybe you want to spend a little bit of time in here. These are the archives. I go, oh, the archives. So imagine a wall of file cabinets the length of this room, maybe this deep. The drawers were about this thick. And in each drawer was about 80 rolls of microfilm. And across the top of the file cabinet were these binders, like big old-fashioned phone books, thick. These were indexes. So they indexed everything. So the different, the HR department, the PR department, the legal affairs department, the legislative affairs department, administration, the general secretary treasurer's department. And so you could actually flip those open, alphabetized, and it could be a company name, a person's name, a theme, and there it would tell you roll LE9 frame 28. From 28 to 47 was these pages on this topic. And so I started spooling those up. You know, there was the name Sinatra. There was, you know, Hoffa's advice, financial advice from Alan Dorfman. And I'd spool through here, and then I'd copy this and I'd print it. And oftentimes it was black with white marks, you know, it was reverse. And it would come out on this kind of greasy old fax type paper. So I was very excited. So then this guy comes in a nice suit, and he is dropping off a bunch of microfilm rolls, and he's taking these boxes of stuff on a little hand cart and taking them away. And he was an outgoing guy. He was a salesman for this photocopying company. And what he was doing was he was making a complete set of the Teamsters records. One roll went into this collection of microfilm, and the other one went to a salt mine in Pennsylvania where they were maintaining their records for posterity. Because you need these to run the union. I mean, you know, it's a giant 1.5 million member union. And so all of a sudden I got this idea. I had this, you know, kind of aha moment where I realized, you know, how much would it cost a dub to copy one of those rolls? There's about 5,000 pages on each. He says, well, it'd be about $9 unless you wanted the silver nitrite, and that would be 15. So I was like, okay. So then so the guy running the library, the archivist, was this guy, Donnie, who didn't say much, and he was like kind of reading sports magazines and men's magazines, and he was unlike any archivist I'd ever run across. Well, it turns out that Donnie had been the private pilot for the previous Teamster president, and when Jackie Presser passed away and they got in a new president of the Teamster who was more reform-minded, and they got rid of the jet, but they didn't get rid of Donnie. So they gave him archives. So they didn't really care too much about history and archives and labor control. So I asked him, I said, hey, could I, you know, I've been down here, I've been in your hair. What if I just got this guy to copy the roles I'm interested in and I'll get out of your hair really quickly? So what do you think of that? So Donnie, the archivist pilot, says, okay, go right ahead. So I put these, you know, I pick out 8 or 9 or 10 of these, like, I'm hoping they're the family jewels, the crown jewels, the smoking gun documents, and he dubs those. So then the next day I'm still there, and then I, how about these? And I get 30. Then the next day, so long story short, I dubbed about $9,000 worth of microfilm that week. Maureen's here, my wife's here. So I put it on a charge card. And I shipped these back to Ohio where I was living. And so then I was at Ohio State and I was teaching journalism and I raised some money. And I thought, well, I went back and then I just started getting more and more. So I ended up basically copying the entire archives all the audio tapes. I dubbed their video. I used a different company for that. I mean, at this point, you know, I was part of the furniture, and Donnie had said it was okay. So and now I've got this, you know, no one has ever seen these journalists, authors, and so I thought, man, I've got it made. You know, this is just going to be a monster blockbuster. And so started spinning through it, and, well, it wasn't that easy. Hoffa was incredibly disciplined guy who, I mean, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he would not keep anything on paper, or he would destroy it. So he would hold up a pencil, and he would lecture his minions. He said, I've seen this tool, this weapon destroy more minds, more men than you could shake a stick at. So what it was he said people are writing stuff down, okay, and they were lame. And what he would do was memorize it, or he would make it part of his mental processes. And so he he would think about a contract or a particularly difficult problem. He wasn't clouded by booze, or, you know, and he didn't run around. He was very, he was like an early health nut, okay? So he would sit there and he would put his fist down on the desk and he'd bring his forefingers over his face, over his nose like this, and bridge it. And then he would just think 2, 3, 4 moves into the future. And just, so he was here, I mean, you know, like 50 years before yoga pants, this guy was practicing mindfulness. And so there wasn't anything, you know, it was really hard. I have to find a little shred here and a little shred there. Well, fortunately, there was these Senate investigative hearings. And I had the copy of the records, but what I realized was they had a fantastic set of documents. Their files were beautiful. Bobby Kennedy was the chief counsel for this committee. And so when he took over this committee in 1957 as chief counsel, they were investigating labor racketeering. And at one point, he got the staff of accountants, FBI agents, and others, up to 100 persons. And so this was my next big find. The problem was Senate investigative records are secret for 50 years. So I had the book contract. I was working on it, but it was 2006. So nothing was going to be available for another year. So I called the publisher, and I said, well, I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news, as they suspected, was I didn't have the book done, and I needed more time. The good news was that I was going to get all these records. So in year 2002, October 2002, I go to the National Archives, and here are all these beautiful records. And I was in this one memo trail, and they said, oh, we can't serve you the rest of those. They called it serving. They would bring out these big boxes. They couldn't serve me because it would take me into November 2007. So anyway, I had to come back year after year as these new boxes of fantastic records were declassified. And so the hearings became this cause celeb that people were watching during the daytime. It was the hottest ticket in D.C. I mean, the Starr hearings, Ken Starr. So to give you a little sense of this, let me just play just a bit. So this is after a lunch break, and Hoffa's with his big entourage out in the hallway. One of Kennedy's investigators heard Hoffa say about somebody, I don't know if it was somebody in bargaining or somebody Kennedy was trying to get in to testify at the hearing, but Hoffa said, ah, that SOB, I'll break his back. So anyway, Kennedy's investigator shared that with Bobby Kennedy, the chief counsel. And this will give you a flavor.
Did you say that SOB, I'll break his back. You.
To who?
To anyone.
Take your speech. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I don't know what you're talking about.
Mr. Hoffman, all I'm trying to find out, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm trying to find out whose back you were going to break.
Take your speech.
I used to love Officer, the bugged little bastard.
So Kennedy wasn't a great lawyer. He wasn't skilled. He had never had experience as a litigator. So he'd get into these convoluted questions, and Hoffa would stare at him. And then, just to destabilize him, Hoffa would wink at him. And Kennedy would get a little, Bobby would get a little destabilized, and it worked. So so I got those were the two legs of the stool. Then one of Kennedy's best investigators, I mean, this guy was he pursued Hoffa almost his entire life as an investigator. His name was Walter Sheridan, fantastic sleuth, worked for NBC News later. He and Bobby were born on the same day. They were like this. And this is a really iconic photo from this time period. This is 1958. It's at the hearings, in the hearing room. Bobby Kennedy on the left, Walter Sheridan in the middle, Hoffa, obviously. So there's four men in here. Everyone is looking in a different direction. But who's the investigative reporter? Who's the investigator? Look at Walter Sheridan. What is he looking at? The document. They're fighting. Hoffa's trying to show him something, and Kennedy's looking over here for help, and Walter is staring at the document. Marianne talked about Fred Otash, and so I thought that I could give you just a little sample of Mr. O. He was, if anybody's seen the movie L.A. Confidential, he was Kevin Spacey, the sleazy private eye who sold secrets to the Gossip magazine, and he had his own network of spies, and what he would do was they would work and spy on Hollywood actors and actresses and businessmen, and then they would go to the Gossip Mag, or he would sell the secrets back to them and take money from them, so kind of a reverse blackmail. But he was really great. He was a former L.A. cop, and so in July of 1960, Jack Kennedy is the nominee. He's coming to L.A. to the Democratic National Convention. Hoffa is terrified that Jack Kennedy is going to be president because he and his brother then will have so much power they'll destroy him. So that year, and this is little told, and it hasn't been fully told until Vendetta, Hoffa tried to destroy Kennedy in the campaign. And in this case, they're at the convention, and Otash, working for Hoffa, got in touch with these quote marks here are from an FBI report that I obtained, got in touch with a, quote, high-priced Hollywood car girl he had cultivated. Otash figured her to be a good candidate to question about salacious conduct by the Kennedys. He pressed her about whether she was ever intimate with John F. Kennedy. He also asked whether she ever had sex with actors Peter Lawford, Frank Sinatra, or Sammy Davis Jr. Otash hadn't selected these three names by chance. Lawford was married to Kennedy's sister Patricia, and through her, Kennedy came to know Sinatra and his crew of Hollywood drinking buddies. For 3 weeks in February, Frank Sinatra and these buddies, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop, and Peter Lawford, spent their days in Las Vegas filming Ocean's 11, a caper flick with a group of veterans robbing Vegas casinos. At night, they performed on stage together at the 800-seat Copa Room in the Sands Hotel. This was such a hot ticket that people would sleep overnight in their cars off the strip so they could get in line to try to score a ticket. With informants everywhere, the FBI noted in its Kennedy file that, quote, a steady stream of chorus line dancers and minor starlets made their way to the senator's motel room at the Sands Casino, close quote. So, anyway, you can see why Hoffa wanted Otash to try to set up Jack Kennedy and his staff at the Democratic National Convention, blackmail. They had to do what they could do to try to destroy him. But it wasn't, I mean, I don't want to make it seem too much like the James Ellroy novel or, you know, Mario Puzo novel. You know, this is entirely based on fact, on documents. And one of the key sets of documents that I did obtain, and Marianne referred to this, Walter Sheridan's personal papers. They went to the Kennedy Library. They were closed. I got his widow, he died in 1995, to give me permission to go look at the records. They hadn't been processed, so I had to sign a waiver. She had to sign a waiver. She's back in Maryland. So actually, you know, it was very exciting to get these old Senate records after 50 years and be the first person to really probably touch them since Bobby Kennedy and his staff. But Walter's papers were even better because they weren't cleaned up. Here were grand jury reports, people they were sicking the IRS on, all sorts of tips and things that, you know, frankly, they shouldn't have let me see. And so I went through that stuff quickly. It's in Boston. Then when I wanted to go back to it, the Kennedy Library would say said no. They weren't going to play that game anymore until the Sheridan family deeded them over to the library, to the archives, and they had a chance to process them and make them available to all. They weren't going to play that game. Well, the Kennedy family still played that game with other hagiographers and things like that. But so I was able to get that in, and thankfully, they did slam the door shut after I got it, because I talked to journalists who cover organized crime or historians and others, and they go, boy, I'd love to see those Walter Sheridan papers. I saw them. Nobody else. So those three document caches, those three gold mines made Vendetta, as far as I'm concerned. I'd like to close with just a, for me, which was a sort of a really poignant part of the story for me. And it was after John F. Kennedy was assassinated and Robert Kennedy was just at a loss. And it's 1964. He's trying to decide what to do. He dedicated his whole life to helping his brother politically, even helping him on the day that his ship docked in Boston and Jack announced for Congress. Bobby actually went AWOL for 2 days. And that fact, you're hearing it for the first time unless you've read the book. Nobody knows that unless you read Vendetta or listen to KOW broadcast this tomorrow. So, Rob, on the final day of the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, Robert Kennedy took the stage to introduce a film about the life of President Kennedy. RFK cast a slight, sad figure, not that of the wiry, relentless pursuer of popular imagination. Yet before he could reach the lectern, the convention hall exploded with a deafening roar from the delegates who had jumped to their feet and were cheering. Only 5 days earlier, he announced he was leaving the Justice Department and running for a seat in the U.S. Senate representing New York, a long-awaited move, one he needed to make in order to step beyond Jack's candescence. With the president's remains entombed beside the eternal flame in the Arlington National Cemetery, his widow in tasteful mourning and isolation, and their two children shielded from public view, a deprived citizenry was transferring its needs to Robert Kennedy. In the hotel ballroom, delegates screamed. Others cried as Bobby let it wash over him. He made moves with his hands as if to say enough, but they refused, pounding their hands and roaring, a raw, brimming expression of loss for the fallen leader. Again, Bobby tried to speak, but had to wait until the crowd exhausted itself. The wild acclaim was truly for his brother, he told himself, but it also revealed that the Kennedy mission was still alive and he would carry it out. After 22 minutes of ovation, he was able to make himself heard and read a passage from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet that he said reminded him of his brother. And when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. Bobby closed his remarks and walked off stage and found a fire escape where he sat down and wept. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Tell us about Senator McClellan, who, as I understood, he was in charge of the hearing.
Senator McClellan was a conservative Democrat, segregationist from Arkansas. So he was in charge of the committee. And he had a lot of personal tragedy, and he really liked Bobby Kennedy. He treated him like a son. And when his Kennedy manipulated McClellan, too. He did all the hiring, and then the staffers would go and meet with McClellan and pretend that they hadn't been hired yet. And so McClellan thought that he was interviewing them and giving him a stamp of approval. So McClellan was a determined investigator. I mean, a determined a committee chair, and he was pretty astute.
So it was just about, was he involved with hiring Bobby as council staff?
Bobby Kennedy was minority council staff earlier on this special committee, the previously known as the McCarthy Committee, when it was in Republicans' hands, and Bobby Kennedy was minority counsel there. Joe McCarthy hired Bobby Kennedy to help him go after communists in government. Joe McCarthy was close with Joe Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's dad. They just, you know, the Irish connection, and I mean, back there. Yeah.
Did you ever meet or interview Beck?
No, Dave Beck died a long time ago. Most of the people, very few people were alive for me to interview, so I had to harvest oral histories, diaries, letters, these documents that are almost contemporaneous accounts of their interviews, and the vast oral histories across the nation at different presidential libraries. So some of the Hoffa Squad, the Get Hoffa Squad prosecutors, I interviewed a few of those, and you know, family members of Walter Sheridan, people like that. So, yes.
Thanks to Robert Caro, we know what the vendetta was between Bobby and Lyndon Johnson. But do you know what Lyndon Johnson thought about Hoffa?
Lyndon Johnson and Hoffa had a marriage of convenience in 1960, and I tell that in Vendetta as well. So in 1960, LBJ was trying to be selected as the presidential candidate through the party bosses and through the back room. And primaries were newfangled ways to build popular support and become president. So LBJ and Hoffa backed Adlai Stevenson to split the convention. And if they could split the convention, it would have, LBJ would have likely been the Democratic nominee, I believe. So there was a deal there that was captured and etched by John Connolly, who later became the Kennedy administration Secretary of the Navy. So, you know, they were political bedfellows who, you know, made a marriage of convenience. Yes, sir.
Oh, so in this vendetta, you've got Hoffa and Kennedy, right? So
right.
Two Kennedy brothers, both assassinated. Hoffa mysteriously disappeared.
The mob killed him in 1975.
Who won the match here?
Well, I would say the allusion to Greek tragedy, which where there really are no winners, is apt. Yes.
Any influence in your book from the Warren Commission report?
I read it. Bobby Kennedy, and I talked to this lawyer, he planted his own spy on the Warren Commission. This guy, a fantastic prosecutor, he prosecuted Hoffa in Tennessee, Charles Schaffer, a fantastic lawyer. He, Bobby wanted somebody on the commission, but he didn't publicly cooperate with the commission and was totally hands-off. He wanted someone to tell him if anything Hoffa-related was turned up. He wanted to know anything Teamsters, Hoffa-related, because when Kennedy was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy, that day, had a couple of suspects, and one of them was Hoffa. And he told Walter Sheridan, the man who was looking at the documentary, he told Walter, do you think Hoffa could be involved with this? Walter said, I think he could. And he said, go to Dallas. And Walter Sheridan hopped to it and went to Dallas to start nosing around. Other questions? I mean, all guys here, come on. Are there no women with questions? There you go. Yes, ma'am.
With the plethora of information that you have, how do you know where to begin?
That's a really good question. So basically, you know, I was kind of paralyzed for a while, but, you know, this is my fifth book. So what I do is I knew it was two guys going mano a mano, doing all they could to destroy each other. I had seen the Walter Sheridan papers. I hadn't gone through all the Teamsters or the Senate stuff. So I had a proposal, and I sold the proposal to Little Brown. So I knew my plot was two guys mano a mano. I knew a lot of the minor characters. So right away I've eliminated a lot of things. So if you stick to that, if I could hang it on that clothesline, it was in the book. If I couldn't, I set it aside.
And how long did this exercise take you?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, it started out as a documentary in the 90s. I got a book deal, you know, maybe 12. I mean, I spent 10 years, but not full time. I mean, if I'd spent full time on it, I would have been done a lot sooner. But, you know, I wouldn't have had the 1959, the 1960, it was due earlier. So I just couldn't stop researching it, and I kept getting better and better stuff. It just got better every step of the way. So at one point, you just have to pinch it off, stop, and then, you know, I was getting, you know, I wouldn't say death threats, but Maureen's over here is like, when are you going to, I'm going to kill you if you don't finish this. My publisher is a little irate, too. Yes, ma'am.
Just out of curiosity, two questions. One, I didn't know that it was understood that Hoffa was murdered by the mob in 1975. That's one question. So does everybody else know that but me? And two, when you had access to these papers at the archive, the last set of papers you spoke about,
yeah.
There was no, did they let you take in paper and pencil so you could make notes?
I photocopied. This was at the Walter Sheridan papers at the Kennedy Library. I photocopied.
And they let you leave the building with them?
Yeah. Yeah, you can go and photocopy stuff. And the archives, the National Archives, allows you to have flatbed scanners now as well. And my son Jameson's here, and we went to this really great archives at Harvard. And so there's a little software called Genius Scan. So you could take, with my phone, I would take a picture of a document, and then the next one, and next one, and next one, just press, and it made linked PDFs. And then I could just press and upload it to my Dropbox file or email to myself or whatever. So you didn't have to pay research fees. And if it wasn't a beautiful copy, I could still read it. We were just zooming through there.
Wow. And so, that was recently, and they didn't try to take your phone away from you? Or?
No, because you're allowed to take camera phone pictures in the at this archive, this special collections library at Harvard. And the National Archives will not allow cut sheet feeder scanners or wand scanners, but a flatbed scanner, and there are entire cottage industries of researchers. You know, do you want flatbed scanner? I mean, they're doing military history. People hire these guys, mostly men, and yeah. So I have thousands and thousands. I have boxes and boxes of paper. Yes, ma'am. Hoffa
and the mob.
It's pretty widely known that the Hoffa was killed by organized crime. The FBI have said it. His son has said it. His daughter, who's a retired lawyer in Missouri, that's what she told me.
Up until 1975?
He got out of prison. He went to prison for jury tampering in 67. Got out in 71. Pardoned by Nixon. Nixon's pardon had a restriction on running, you know, the Teamsters. In 1975, he's running for president of the Teamsters. The mob likes the weak guy, the coat holder that Hoffa put in 67. Hoffa's running on an anti-corruption, anti-mob campaign. I'm going to clean up the union. The mob killed him. The Tony Provenzano family out of New Jersey. And that's kind of the accepted wisdom. Everything I've learned doesn't contradict that. So, you know, that's what happened in 1975. Thanks for reminding me on that question. Now, who did I call on? I called on you, yes.
Well, I was just interested because, you know, the Seattle Times did the sort of promoted your book through Dave Beck, you know, because he's our local connection. And I actually went back to the kind of family archives and found a picture of Dave Beck and Jimmy Hoffa. And I just wonder how much Beck was in on the national, you're hanging up your coat, very nice. Was in on the sort of national scams because, you know, he's our hometown boy here.
He used a labor fixer to pay for his house, pay for his furniture, buy booze, I mean, clothing, nylons. I mean, he cut deals. He used organized crime, thuggery in the 30s like everybody else did when the corporations had their own goons. You know, it was, I mean, the bloody 30s. So as Robert Kennedy said, Beck was just a thief. Hoffa is evil, and he can destabilize our economy, and he thought Hoffa was as bad as the equivalent of Hoffa to the Red Scare. So Beck was I would say that's a oversimplified but pretty accurate thief versus evil. Yeah.
Which page in your book do you tell us where Hoffa is buried?
Did everybody hear that question? I've never gotten that one. I don't, but he's in Michigan. I know that.
Not the Meadowlands?
That's been debunked. No, that's totally been debunked. That was a con man who conned Playboy magazine. He told different stories before he told them that one. Yeah, no, that one's totally, totally gone. Yes, ma'am.
Did J. Edgar Hoover have any role?
Oh, big, big time. He didn't like the Kennedys, and he did not help Bobby Kennedy try to bring Hoffa down. He would do what Bobby Kennedy told him to do, because Bobby was his boss, his AG. But Hoover was a really, really weird guy. But he was a supremely gifted bureaucratic infighter. Amazing, amazing. And he set traps for Bobby Kennedy in 61, you know, memos, things like that didn't pay off until 1967, 1968. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, he kept really good files on Jack Kennedy, Senator Kennedy. I mean, he had every assignation that he could find. And so these were all his really good files, and he took those and kept them in his office so other agents couldn't see him. And he would use that to blackmail and, oh, this memo. He would send a memo to Bobby Kennedy. Oh, this woman said something about this affair with Jack or with you. But, you know, we just wanted you to know. And Bobby's like, you know. I mean, he could have destroyed Jack Kennedy with leaks. Yeah, he could have. But he didn't. Back here. Way in the back, sir.
You said that Robert Kennedy thought Hoffa was evil. After all your research and doing everything, learning all, what do you think?
I think that I started with, again, to oversimplify, Bobby Kennedy, good guy, Hoffa, bad guy. And the more I learned, the more I realized there's incredible shades of gray. They both had their bad points, and they both had good points. So, I mean, they kind of both kind of regressed to the mean a little bit, but I would say that, you know, Hoffa maintained his grip as president of the Teamsters Union. If he wasn't delivering, if he couldn't do the job for the membership, he would have been gone. So he had an incredibly powerful following. He was a genius transportation economist. He was a gifted bargainer. I mean, he could get to the sort of the sweet spot where it was fair to both sides, but you kind of got all you could faster than anybody. And he knew where it was, and he got frustrated when he couldn't get there fast enough, and he sort of became dictatorial. And then after the fact, the companies were okay with it and the membership was okay with it. So he had some, you know, some marvelous talents. He was a smart, driven guy who, you know, ninth grade education. Dad died when he was like 4 years old, so very, you know, like Dave Beck, he came up the hard way. Any other questions? I think we're getting kind of close to, I mean, we've got to start signing books in a moment. Yes, sir. Sorry. Yes.
Clearly there is some personal component here with, you know, just RFK versus Hoffa, but what are the, like the larger forces that I guess are at play here? Why does a guy with the U.S. government's resources at hand, why is he taking on, you know, union chiefs so hard? How does it become organizational to personal?
That's a great question. It became organizational personal because it was so intensely personal at the beginning. Hoffa, as was his wont, he was very tough. He would attack. He'd be personal. He'd use every trick in the book. And Bobby Kennedy was personally affronted. He tried to humiliate Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy was sort of the run of the litter in the Kennedy family. And, you know, he was. And he was small. And some of his letters to his father, just like begging him to write him letters when he was away at prep school, like you did with Joe and like you did with Jack. I mean, he really wanted to prove himself, and he was so determined. They were both relentless, driven guys, and when you put those two in collision like that, Kennedy could move that committee, and people liked working for him. He could motivate. He had a lot of charisma. When you first met him, you didn't like him, but he won you over, and when he became Attorney General, he turned, you know, despite Hoover's recalcitrance, and he really turned the bureaucracy towards organized crime. Then, I believe, you know, he overstepped with focusing not on the crimes, but on the person. So he had 20 prosecutors alone on the Get Hoffa squad, and all they were doing were running grand juries all across the country. They could find something. And, you know, the first one they were able to bring against him was actually a misdemeanor for an old case that had been picked over in these Senate hearings. So it was a combination of these two. And I don't think you'll ever see anything quite like this again. I mean, and just the language you heard in that YouTube, I mean, those days are gone, I think. I mean, anyway. So we should be signing books. It's really hot in here. It's 10 to 8. I think I can maybe answer some questions as we go through the book line. Thank you. Thank you for coming out.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you could leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. James Neff is a Seattle-based journalist and the author of Vendetta, Bobby Kennedy versus Jimmy Hoffa. Neff has directed multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning series as investigations editor at the Seattle Times. His other books include The Wrong Man, Unfinished Murder, and Mobbed Up. James Neff spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 13, 2015. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.